This 5 hour was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headline.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Suspected Kurdish militants set off a car bomb near a courthouse in Turkey's western city of Izmir, killing a police officer and a courthouse employee. There's been no claim of responsibility for Thursday's car bombing, which followed the New Year's shooting rampage at a nightclub in Istanbul where 39 people were killed. The Islamic State claimed responsibility. Reports say authorities are closing in on a gunman who has been at large since the shooting. Top U.S. spy chiefs have testified the evidence is firm that Russia interfered with the U.S. presidential election. National Intelligence Director James Clapper spoke before the Senate Armed Services Committee.
This was a multifaceted campaign. So the hacking was only one part of it. And it also entailed classical propaganda, disinformation, fake news.
President-elect Donald Trump, who has made no secret of his admiration of Russian President Vladimir Putin, has said he has serious doubts Russia was involved in the hacking. U.S. Defense Chief Ash Carter says President-elect Trump's administration should maintain partnerships with NATO and allies in the Asia-Pacific, while also holding Russia accountable to its stated mission of battling terrorists in Syria and helping end the war. The recommendations came in a memo that Carter, like other cabinet secretaries, prepared to highlight what their departments achieved during the 8-year presidency of Barack Obama. The documents released Thursday, along with a letter from Mr. Obama, about 2 weeks before Mr. Trump takes office. This is VOA News. At least 9 people were killed. It happened when a car bomb exploded in a coastal town in Syria. It was the first such explosion reported since a new ceasefire was implemented last week. The ceasefire in Syria appeared fragile even before the attack as government forces escalated their offensive near the capital Damascus, and a coalition of rebel groups said they would suspend their participation in preliminary peace talks set for later this month. Ceasefire excludes extremist targets, including rebel-held territory on the outskirts of Damascus. Leaders of ethnically divided Cyprus will resume reunification talks on Monday after negotiations broke down last month. The Greek Cypriot and Turkish Cypriot leaders agreed to meet in Geneva to discuss the state of the negotiations and to exchange views on how to move forward in the interest of reaching a comprehensive settlement and to do that as soon as possible. Talks are aimed at drafting an agreement on how much territory each side will control in an envisioned federation. A rising tide of automation and some trade deals have cost the United States millions of manufacturing jobs in recent years, leaving many people unemployed or in jobs with poor pay and no future. Meantime, U.S. companies can't find people with technical skills to fill critical jobs. Many advanced nations make use of apprenticeships, but U.S. firms have cut them sharply. VOA's Jim Randall reports a U.S. shipbuilding company is using old-school techniques that blend classwork and practical experience to build a high-tech workforce.
Apprentices, including Jordan Lacey, are helping to build the USS New Jersey.
It starts as a pile of pieces, and when it leaves, it's a finished unit.
The first-year apprentice at Newport News Shipbuilding also worked on a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier and looks forward to switching from paper plans to computer drawings.
How about a machinist? What's a machinist do?
He can learn design and other skills in class. The apprentice school's more than 700 students are paid company employees.
I think it's an education with a purpose, really.
Former apprentice Everett Jordan is director of education and says mixing classroom and practical training pays off. More than shipbuilding goes on here as apprentices learn many skills, including computer modeling. Jim Randall, VOA News, Newport News, Virginia.
And you can get more on that story, plus the rest of the hour's news at voanews.com. We're also always available on the VOA mobile app.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The Nigerian army says it rescued yet another Chibok girl from Boko Haram captivity.
She has been given some medical treatment. She's in good health, including the child she's holding. And just a few minutes ago, the Nigerian military handed over her to the Borno State governor.
Brigadier General Sani Kukesh Usman is acting Nigerian Army spokesman. We'll speak with a spokesman for the Rebel National Democratic Movement about fighting this week in South Sudan's Upper Nile State. We also get a situation report about the political crisis in the Gambia. And Ghana's former ruling National Democratic Congress Party deliberates on the reasons for its election loss.
If we all don't do some careful introspection and openly show remorse for the betrayal of the people's trust, we might not recover in time for the next election.
That's former Ghanaian President Jerry Rawlings. And Zimbabwe battles a new typhoid outbreak. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's post and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Nigerian army says it has rescued one of the 276 schoolgirls abducted 2 years ago by the terrorist group Boko Haram. Acting military spokesman Brigadier General Sani Kukasheka Usman says the girl, Rakia Abubakar, and her six-month-old baby were discovered during investigation of an arrested Boko Haram terrorist. The rescue comes as the group Bring Back Our Girls prepares to observe this Sunday the 1,000th day that the Chibok girls have spent in Boko Haram captivity. Brigadier General Usman says the military shares the pain of the girls' parents and wants to reassure them that the military will not rest until every abducted girl is brought home. He says the rescued girl and her baby were given medical treatment and turned over to the governor of the northeastern Nigerian state of Borno.
If you recall, some time ago, quite a number of Boko Haram terrorists were arrested. And in the process of screening and interrogation, we found that Rekia Abubakar was indeed among those Chibok schoolgirls that were abducted on the 14th of April 2014. And she was a class 3 student. You know, we have both junior and senior secondary school. So she was in the senior secondary school category. It means she was a final year student, specifically class SS3B, when the abduction took place. And she was discovered with a six-month-old baby. She has been given some medical treatment. She's in good health, including the child she's holding. And just a few minutes ago, the Nigerian military handed over her to the Borno State governor.
Brigadier General, the anniversary of these Chibok girls, I think there's a special anniversary for January 8th. If you were to talk to the parents of some of the girls who are still to be rescued, what would you say as a military person trying to make sure that all these girls are free? What would you tell those parents?
We definitely have always been with the parents, just like every other well-meaning Nigerian and the human being on this earth. We have been with them, and we share their despair and their pains of missing their children. And on our own part, we will continue to reassure them that whoever that is being held captive by the Boko Haram terrorists, wherever they are, we are determined to rescue that person and reunite him or her with their families. And we will definitely do that.
We hear again that more and more Boko Haram terrorists have surrendered. What can you tell us on that?
Yeah, quite a number of them have surrendered. Just yesterday, 10 of them were publicly shown, and they made confessional statements in which they stated that actually, they were misled. They never knew that that was what Boko Haram was all about. And they are now remorseful. And they have been calling on all those Boko Haram terrorists elsewhere, wherever they are, to renounce their disbelief and come to surrender themselves so that they can be treated humanely. And they also praised the Nigerian authority, particularly the military, that they expected the worst from them, but they were, you know, pleasantly surprised that they were treated humanely. And they are treated, with decency, and they call on their counterparts to please lay down their arms and report themselves to the security agencies. This has been going on, and I'm sure it is going to be on more so now that Nigerians are more vigilant, more security conscious, that the Boko Haram terrorists, wherever they might be hiding, may not have the freedom of movement or action. So the best thing is for them to, present themselves to the security agencies. On our own part, we are determined to ensure that wherever the remnants of Boko Haram terrorists have been hiding, once we are informed, definitely will be in their pursuit to make sure that they are apprehended and they are prosecuted.
Brigadier General, thank you very much again. It's so nice to talk with you.
It is my pleasure too.
Brigadier General Sani Kukasheka Osman is the acting Nigerian Army spokesman. He was speaking with me from Abuja. Ghana will inaugurate its new president and parliamentary members this Saturday. The peaceful transfer of power is celebrated as a key win for one of Africa's most stable democracies, but it was also a defeat for the country's former ruling party, the National Democratic Congress, which has now embarked on some soul-searching. Francesca Kekra-Fortson reports for VOA from Accra.
The 2016 elections in Ghana saw something new happen. The incumbent lost. John Mahama leaves office as a one-term president.
I don't think I was the only one who saw the writing on the wall.
That's Jerry Rawlings, Ghana's political godfather and former president. He's a member of the NDC and was notably absent from Mahama's re-election campaign.
Our general negativity, impunity, disrespect and corruption was taking us further and further downhill. We had lost so much goodwill. If we all don't do some careful introspection and openly show remorse for the betrayal of the people's trust, we might not recover in time for the next election.
The NDC came to power in 2009 with the election of President John Atta Mills. 3 years later, Mills died in office, and Mahama, his deputy, took over and then won the election later that year. But President-elect Nana Akufo-Addo defeated Mahama at the polls in December by a margin of 1 million votes. The NDC also lost its majority in parliament. Some have drawn parallels to the fall of the People's Democratic Party in Nigeria. The 2015 elections saw an opposition coalition push the PDP out at all levels of government, including the presidency. Mahama now joins his former Nigerian counterpart, Goodluck Jonathan, in the small club of single-term African presidents. Some of the reasons behind their downfall were similar: economic hardship, lack of reliable electricity, corruption, and rising unemployment. In Ghana, political analyst Bosman Asare says poor performance by the government and overconfidence cost the NDC the election.
Over the years, the democratic space has been expanding. Transparency has been increasing. Voters are increasingly becoming more sophisticated. So we've gotten to a point in our democracy, just like many advanced societies like Britain, Germany, USA, where incumbency is no longer significant.
How about internally? What didn't they do right?
The NDC for many years has been relying on the rural voters. And when you look at Ghana, the voting dynamics in Accra, within main Accra, the MPP will win. But once the villages come, then you realize the NDC will be leading. So I think the NDC took that for granted that, no, these are people who will always come home.
And that may be a lesson for the NPP and President-elect Akufo-Addo as they now take the reins of the country. Voters are expecting results. Francisca Kakra-Forson for VOA News, Accra.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 6th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's send shout out to listeners on all our affiliate stations in Ghana. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. The Gambian government says the country's international airport will remain open, contrary to what it says is fabrication by opposition news sites in the United States, that the airport will be closed beginning January 10th. This is according to the Gambian opposition Freedom Online newspaper, quoting a statement by the Gambian government. In another development, the Freedom Online newspaper says foreign judges, mostly from Nigeria and Sierra Leone, and handpicked by President Jammeh to hear his election petition, are expected to arrive in the Gambia this weekend. The court is expected to begin hearing the petition next Tuesday. As Ricky Shryak reports for VOA from Dakar, President Jammeh's rhetoric has grown increasingly defiant and hawkish this week as his government clamps down on dissidents.
Gambian President Yahya Jammeh has continued to dig in his heels with less than 2 weeks to go before the scheduled inauguration of President-elect Adama Barrow. Jammeh has shut at least three private radio stations and, according to local news sites, authorities have arrested people wearing T-shirts with the slogan, "Gambia has decided," a known statement of Barrow's supporters. The head of the Electoral Commission fled to neighboring Senegal after Jammeh said in his New Year's address the elections chief had falsified results. Jammeh added that no one would cheat him. It was seen as a veiled threat. The Senegal Regional Director of Rights Group Article 19, Fatou John Senghor, says activists still hope for a peaceful transfer of power.
You see, it has been very clear that after the reversal of his decision, he targeted openly the Electoral Commission. And after that, he sealed their office. And all those days, this institution was not functioning. So you never know also what the security apparatus is capable of doing in such difficult situation.
The Jammeh government has been accused of numerous rights abuses during its 22 years in office, including arbitrary arrest, torture, and forced disappearances. The U.S. State Department Human Rights Report said officials routinely used various methods of intimidation to retain power. Jammeh initially accepted defeat in the December polls, but reversed course, calling for new elections. But the international community has recognized Barrow as the winner. West African Regional Bloc ECOWAS put its standby force on alert, with Senegal at the lead. Jammeh hit back in his New Year's speech, saying an ECOWAS deployment would be a declaration of war. But the regional approach appears to be negotiation, and Senegalese President Macky Sall says military intervention should be a last resort. The founder of West African citizens think tank Gil Yabi says there may still be a path to a peaceful exit.
I think it is true that Jammeh is a very special person, and it is difficult to imagine traditional diplomatic pressures having some impact on Jammeh. But I think that when thinking about pressures, it's not just about official threats or traditional diplomatic ways. I think it is also about changing the calculation of the people who are around Jammeh and the military leaders of the country. The objective of ECOWAS could be to make them change their minds by making very clear that Jammeh will not stay in power.
This week, Gambia's army chief reaffirmed his support for Jammeh in a letter published in a pro-government newspaper. International military historian at the University Felix Ufwe Boigny in Abidjan, Arthur Banga, says the Gambian military would likely be no match for ECOWAS forces. He says hopefully it will not come to that. He says it would look very bad for the ECOWAS region and democracy in general if Jammeh is still in power 2 or 3 weeks from now. Ricky Shryock for VOA News, Dakar.
In South Sudan, forces of the Rebel National Democratic Movement and troops loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar this past Wednesday fought over control of Hamram Village in Upper Nile State. Ambassador Emmanuel Aban, spokesman for the National Democratic Movement, says one of their senior commanders, General Gabriel Tang, was killed during the attack on Hamra. He blames SPLA in opposition forces loyal to Mr. Machar for the attack and accuses them of not being interested in restoring peace to South Sudan.
The fighting is between a combination of SPLA, MIO, and Oloin, who is also working with Taban. They have mounted a heavy attack on our forces on the 3rd at Hamra, which is in northern Upper Nile State. And we managed to repulse the attacking force, leaving a lot of casualties behind them in the battlefield.
When your movement was formed, the National Democratic Movement, when I asked you specifically what is the agenda of this movement, You told me the agenda was to fight the government of President Kiir. Now you're telling me you're fighting with Riek Machar. What's going on?
First of all, our agenda has not changed. Our main objective is to fight Salva Kiir and salvage the country from the yoke of tribalism, patronistic system that is there, and also to have a democratic, stable South Sudan where all the 64 tribes are equal and where we all equal before the constitution. What happened in Hamra, we did not initiate the attack. It was an unprovoked attack by Agwelek and the SPLM-IO against our position in Hamra. So it is not us fighting them. It is indeed them attacking us. So the question should be for Riek and his SPLM-IO, if they are genuinely, as they claim, that they're fighting the government in Juba, then they should be attacking the garrison of Wadokona, which is a stone throw from where they are, their forces, rather than attacking us in Hamra.
What is the casualty figure in this latest fighting in Hamra?
We counted 25 bodies of the attacking force, and we did manage to capture around 4 to 5 POWs. On our side, we did lose a couple of our soldiers and especially one of our generals.
I'm seeing postings on social media that one militia leader in South Sudan was killed in the fighting. Could you tell us more about this general?
First, I would like to make a correction. We are not militias. I don't know what is the category of calling other people militias. We are not. We are freedom fighters who are fighting for freedom and fighting to liberate South Sudan from dictatorship. Yes, General Gabriel Tangin was martyred yesterday. His car fell into an ambush, and as a result, he was martyred.
What do you mean by he was martyred?
He died in the battlefield.
Which side was he fighting on? I mean, does he belong to your group or to the other group?
Yeah. He is one of our senior generals in the National Democratic Movement.
Help me to explain this to South Sudanese. At this point, a lot of people are looking for an end to the fighting because the suffering is just too much for everybody in South Sudan. The economic situation is very dire. People are not able to put food on their tables. Civil servants are not getting their salaries. And the situation is just unbearable. And here you are talking about fighting. What is your justification for carrying up arms?
John, you know very well that the war in the country in South Sudan was forced upon people by Kiir and his government in Juba. War is never anybody's choice, neither is it a favorite choice, but it has been forced upon Southern Sudanese.
The government in Juba would also say they are not able to deliver services, they are not able to pay the civil servants because people like you are not laying down your arms. You are fighting and you are making life difficult for civilians.
The war started in 2013, but before that, things were not rosy. The government was having difficulties delivering services. It's not only because of the war, but because of level of corruption and the lack of having a clear road, economical roadmap to take the South Sudan and to develop economically to be strong.
House Ambassador Emmanuel Aban, spokesman for the Rebel National Democratic Movement of South Sudan's former Agriculture Minister Lam Akol, who was speaking to viewers John Tanza from Salisbury in the U.S. state of Virginia. An outbreak of typhoid in Zimbabwe's capital has killed 2 people and is affecting more than 100 others. The outbreak is raising fears that the southern African country's water and sanitation problems are far from over. Sebastian Mofu has more from Harare.
Officials say that so far 126 cases of typhoid have been confirmed since the start of the rainy season in Zimbabwe about 2 months ago. There are more than 1,000 other suspected cases nationwide. But Dr. Prosper Chonzi, who heads the Harare Health Department, says there's no need to panic.
What we are doing is to educate the public on awareness issues to do with typhoid, what it is, how it is spread, how do you avoid getting it. We also discourage people from consuming food from undesignated premises. So far, in terms of water and sanitation, our city of Harare teams are in Mbare de-blocking the sewer pipes, making sure that there is no free-flowing sewer. They are also dedicating supplies of water to those areas.
A visit to the areas he referred to and other parts of Harare on Wednesday tells a different story. Forces are dry and sewer water could be seen flowing while some people were using water from open sources like lakes and rivers. The executive director of Community Working Group on Health, Itairu CK, says President Robert Mugabe's government did not learn much from the 2008-2009 rainy season, when an outbreak of cholera claimed more than 4,000 lives in Zimbabwe.
The fundamental public health issues that were supposed to have been attended to from the earlier crisis have not yet been attended to. Authorities are taking advantage of the outdated Public Health Act that we are currently using, enacted way back in 1924. And public health trends have changed. This is why you find it is easier for City of Harare to pollute our water body and pay the fine, a very small fine.
The pollution he refers to is raw sewer water discharging into rivers, which some people rely on for daily use. Those using the contaminated river can easily contract waterborne diseases such as typhoid and cholera. Typhoid, an infectious bacterial fever, can be treated with antibiotics but still kills more than 220,000 people worldwide each year. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
And it's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning, James. We begin with the GLOCAF Awards ceremony for 2016, which ended a few hours ago here in Abuja, Nigeria.
And the winner of the 25th African Player of the Year Award is... The winner is Riyad Mahrez.
The 25-year-old who helped his club Leicester City lift their first ever Premier League title pulled a total of 361 votes to beat 2015 CAF African Player of the Year winner Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, who had 313 votes, and Sadio Mane, who came third with 186 votes. Riyad Mahrez attributed his success to his teammates.
This award, I'm very happy, I'm very pleased. I want to thank all my teammates from Leicester and from Algeria, my managers, and my president of the Federation as well. And I want to dedicate to my family and all the African, of course, Algerian as well, and all the people who support me every day around Africa and around the world. Thank you.
In 2016 alone, Mahrez won the PFA Players Player of the Year, as well as the PFA Fans Player of the Year, and also won the BBC African Footballer of the Year award.
And the Club of the Year 2016 is Mamelodi Sundowns.
However, it was Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa who, however, dominated the night of awards, as the Brazilians went home with the African Club of the Year award, while coach Pitso Mosimane was named African Coach of the Year. Dennis Onyango of Uganda and Mamelodi Sundowns goalkeeper was awarded the African Player of the Year based in Africa. Other winners from the 2016 GLOCAF Awards include the Super Falcons of Nigeria, who won the Women National Team of the Year, while the Cranes of Uganda was named the National Team of the Year.
And the 2016 Most Promising Talent Award goes to Kelechi Iheanacho.
And the 2016 Youth Player of the Year is Alex Iwobi.
Tanzania music art Diamond Platinums and Afrobeat maestro Femi Kuti were on hand to entertain guests with thrilling performances, which included those coming from Omawomi and Yemi Alade, all Nigerian music stars. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Over to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, for that beautiful report. Have a very good weekend. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Bartis saying have a lovely weekend.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. African Beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
60, 80.